problem with the time argument you're putting forth is that as time has gone on, that oil has gotten harder and harder to handle. So, you know, I just think that you're beating on the wrong drum on that one.
Exxon, Jeff Berliner, UPI. Exxon seems to be mounting quite an effort with skimmers to scoop up the oil. This seems to be something that DEC Commissioner Kelso had been harping on from the beginning when Exxon's first line of defense was chemical dispersants and its second line of defense was burning, neither of which were completely successful. Does this make you think that perhaps in the first 3 days of calm weather when the state was urging you to use skimmers that you should have been doing what you're doing now?
Absolutely not. You can see how slow skimming is. There's no way in the world we could have skimmed that oil. The contingency plan for Alaska calls in a spill that big if you got to hit it with dispersant. And you got to burn it. I think Don told you how many barrels were burned in just a very short test. 18,000 barrels, I think, is a number. This mechanical skimming, I don't care if you round up all the skimmers in the world, which we're in the process of doing, and I don't care how effective it's called relative to other skimmings, it is a very slow process. Yes, sir.
Scott, Dan Sadler, Anchorage Times. I'm curious to know how many fishermen have made claims that have been paid off, and are you in contact with state agencies concerning compensation and accounting for what they're spending on your behalf?
The state's keeping their books, and I'm sure they'll tell us all about it. I think we've made one transfusion already, or about to, or had they have asked. The claims are coming in, and we are making preliminary payments. The claims that are coming in are just provisional because people really don't know the extent of their damage. So they are coming in to both the Cordova and the Valdez office, and they are being processed.
Are you working with the state offices that Governor Cooper said he was going to establish?
We are working with many, many state agencies. I think I was in a meeting last night. It went from about 8 to 11, and I think there are 12 or so state agencies in that room. So there's a very, very cooperative effort going on, and everybody is being satisfied all the way along the way. Just the selection of the safe haven for the vessel took us about 3 or 4 days. It wasn't any time constraint on it, but during that time it was just consulting, discussing, and looking at different aspects of it. So that's been going on every step of the way.
One last question. How much money have you paid out so far?
I don't know.
Mr. Iorossi, Brian Bland, AP Radio. Going back to the flotation one more time, is there a kind of window of opportunity here? Will you know within 10 minutes after the very highest tide whether flotation has worked, or a half an hour, or how long will it be till you say we'll have to watch again tomorrow?
I would say that probably by, I'm really guessing now, Brian, maybe an hour or so after high tide, we'll decide that we didn't catch this one. We'll wait for the next one. Yes, ma'am.
Back to the Navy skimmers, which you said were on the East Coast. I'm sorry, Cass Peterson with the Washington Post. You said that there were a number of Navy skimmers on the East Coast. How long will it take those skimmers to get here? Are you picking up the tab? And how long are skimmers effective against a spill like this? Are you talking months from now that you'll still have skimmers out there?
The Navy stockpile, as I understand it, was split between California and Virginia. We've been flying equipment from the Southampton, UK area. I mean, we're flying stuff from all over the world. I think the skimmers are coming in on C-5As. We've had a number of C-5A flights already. Those are those big, giant military planes. And I'm sure it'll catch up with us with the cost on all of it. There is a mechanism for such that federal agency expenditures are reimbursable, so I'm sure we'll be seeing that. Did you ask me a question in there that I didn't answer?
Yeah, how long do you think a skimmer is effective against a skill like this?
We're already seeing some breakdowns out in the field. Those units have been operating now for over a week and some very heavy service. That's why we have the Arctic Salvor out there. That's a very big repair, has a very big repair in machine shop and a big crane, so it's able to lift these units right on the deck. So we think we'll be running a very large-scale repair operation out there for some time.
Don, it's been nearly 2 weeks since the spill. The oil spill now covers more than 1,000 square miles. Wouldn't it have been a lot better to start skimming last week sometime when the oil was...
It would have been a lot better to hit it with dispersant, as the contingency plan called for. All of the skimmers that were here and all of the skimmers that we could get here on day 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 were moved here. I'm not sure of the point of the question. As soon as we can get them here, we put them in service, and they're working.
About the dispersants, even your own experts say that the dispersants are only effective on at most 50% of the oil on the surface. Others say as little as 10%.
The limitations of the skimmer were recognized when the contingency plan was prepared, and also the limitations of the delivery system throughout the world to get them to the point where they're needed was recognized. And if you look in the Alyeska pipeline contingency plan, the scenario for a 200,000 barrel spill, which is very similar to what we have here, said you would use the skimmers that were approved in the plan as a first attack, but that the primary attack of a spill of that magnitude in Prince William Sound would be the utilization of dispersants. But we always recognized if that failed and the oil got to where it is today, we would have a major skimming operation and a major shoreline cleanup operation, and that is exactly what we have today, and that's why we continue to bring in skimmers, and we will continue to bring them in, and we'll continue to use them until there's no oil on the water that can be skimmed.
Carrie Moran with NBC Mutual. Is it true that if, in fact, you had tried to contain the spill, say, within the first 3 hours when all of the oil virtually spilled out of the ship, that you might have had an explosive situation there, considering the concentration of fumes and whatnot? Can Frank address that?
Yeah, a few were up in a helicopter even the first 3 or 4 days, and you were anywhere near the surface, within 100 or 200 feet, that oil was gasifying very rapidly, and that's the evaporization that someone was talking about going on. I was up for about 2 hours in a Coast Guard helicopter on Monday afternoon after the big gale came through, so that was about day 3 or 4. At that point, the gasification was still so heavy that after 2 hours, I had my head out the window looking down, and I felt a little... off. So there was a lot of gasification going on, and really the worst thing we could have done early on was to try to boom the vessel, because we'd have lost the whole vessel. There was so much gas coming up off of the crude as it was vaporizing that we would have had an enormous gas bubble over that ship.
Would that have occurred even 10, 15, 20 hours after the spill?
It was gasifying 3 days later by enormous amounts. Yes,
that raises a question. The contingency plan, nonetheless, in a big spill, $200,000 barrel spill, still called for...
I wish it was
$200,000. called for containment of the vessel by boom within, you know, a certain amount of time, very short, three hours, I think. Why was the possibility of this type of gasification not understood at the time the contingency plan said, well, when this 200,000 barrels goes jetting out into the sea, we'll contain it within 3 hours?
I don't know that. And let me just clarify. We, to my knowledge, we didn't, Exxon didn't interfere with placing the boom around, but there were Coast Guard officers on board, and I think they were as concerned as we were. But I don't know what communication was going back and forth at that time.
Well, the bottom line is that you could not have contained this spill, or you would have lost the tanker. It would have blown up. It would have been a bomb.
That's exactly what we say. And the gasification was enormous, and we really did not want it trapped around a ship. But we'd have had a 1,240,000 barrel problem rather than 240,000. Yes?
Jeff Berliner, UPI. I have a question for the Coast Guard, Commander McCall. When this...
Did you want to finish this guy off,
person? Finish that guy off, folks.
That's how you want to do it. But...
In order to refloat the ship and have the tugs lead it from Bligh Reef, where it's grounded, to Outside Bay and Naked Island, we'll have to cross the shipping lanes the tankers use. During this process, will the port be closed, the oil terminal at Valdez be closed?
That's because you guys haven't been patrolling.
And also, the Coast Guard briefly relaxed its restrictions on the port and then reimposed them. And I'm wondering if the restrictions were relaxed at the urging of the oil industry, and why the state wasn't consulted, and what the procedure will be for future controls at the port.
Okay, first off, concerning the salvage operation.
Talk to the microphone.
Concerning the salvage operation, the port will be closed to tanker traffic. Around the Exxon Valdez, there will be a 1,000-yard safety zone for the protection of the general public, and also for the protection and ability to operate of the salvage crew. So, for small vessels, the port will not be closed. For commercial vessels, oil tankers, large vessels, it will be effectively closed until we get the tanker out of the way. The question of opening and closing the port, within an hour after the ship ran aground, I closed the port within my authority as the captain of the port, federal responsibility. On Tuesday or Wednesday, I forget now exactly which, we reopened the port up to daylight operations of tanker traffic after the immediate threat of the tanker was reevaluated, and we had a good feeling that it was not going to move on us, and also the oil had moved out of the way. So there was no legal reason why I could not open the port to allow tanker traffic back in. We did it during daylight hours only because we were still unsure as to what we had condition-wise in the area, and didn't want to take any risks at night. Sunday afternoon, with a little less than 100,000 barrels left on board the ship, and after extensive overflights that I made, witnessing tanker traffic out and tanker traffic in, I made the decision that night to allow tanker traffic back in, which was in my authority to do. We did not discuss it with the state, and early Monday morning the state expressed concern, and I recognized their concern, and then we backed off. It was as simple as that. And that's basically where we stand right now, back to daylight operations only. And, sir, you have a question?
There's a letter.
Do you have a question?
Yeah.
Yes, sir. There's a lady behind you.
Yeah, I had a question about the certification of the vessel. Is it correct that the vessel was, let me see if I have this straight, put to sea in 86 and certified finally in 1988? And is that normal procedure? Is there any window in there?
No. When the Exxon Valdez was originally put in service, it would have had to have been Coast Guard certified prior to being put into service.
Was not a two-year differential in the date of service and the date of final certification?
No. There's other processes that have to be renewed every 2 years, but the ship was put into service correctly.
Question from Bob King with Alaska Public Radio. Is there any evidence of any structural damage to the ship while it's been riding on the tides? Is it any deck plates warping or separating or?
From the deck surface, no. But
besides the hull, or
but on the bottom, I'm sure there is, because there is the salvors and my people on board have indicated that there's sounds going on down below that.
That's the integrity of the keel on this.
Well, the salvage experts assure us that it's intact, and the salvage plan, aside from being approved by the American Bureau of Shipping, is in the process of being finalized and approved by the Coast Guard at the Washington level, where our naval architects are located.
Let's take about 4 or 5 more questions. We're running really long.
This gentleman, NBC News. Have you done anything since the incident to assure that ship's officers or men have not been drinking when they get on board?
Not anything more than what is currently within the regulations.
Has Exxon done anything
to tighten up its control?
Well, we know we think that control was tight. We obviously had a situation in which the individual most responsible did not fill his function. We have made sure that all the masters of our vessels understand their duty in this regard. We are looking at all of our procedures and looking at what alternatives we have to make them fail safe.
You're saying it's the same thing could happen again, basically.
I doubt if it will. It won't.
Yeah, there are two questions in the cracks here. One, we did not get an answer to the question of why, if booming a ship makes it into a bomb, why is that part of the contingency plan? And two, we did not get an answer to the question of how long will the oil be skimmable, assuming the skimmers are working?
The last question first. The oil is going to remain skimmable as long as we are using the belt-type skimmers, and that's what we're concentrating on bringing in now. As long as it's on the surface, it's recoverable. It's not recoverable with the type of skimmers that are normally in place in terminals for lighter oil. So that's why we need...
I don't mean to interrupt, but in terms of days and hours under present weather conditions, I understand that if the equipment were here, it would do its thing. But assuming the oil has its own thing to do, too, and that's what I'm asking.
As far as movement of the oil?
Movement, vibration, breaking down, sinking, etc.
As long as the weather conditions and light winds in particular remain, that oil isn't moving very fast. So we're going to be skimming as fast as we can. We're going to be trapping it in the bays where it already is so that it doesn't get out and soil any other areas. Yeah, another question, I forgot what it was.
If booming a vessel of this nature would turn it into a bomb, why is that part of the contingency plan?
It's a function of how much oil was in the water. You know, there were 240, I think the Coast Guard said that the oil stopped bubbling to the surface within 3 hours or something like that. So you had... 240,000 barrels of oil released right around the vessel. I mean, it didn't move very far. So you had an enormous amount of oil right around the vessel, and that created the very high quantity of gas coming off. If you had a smaller spill or if you had had a movement that was much faster that was moving the oil away, you wouldn't have that problem. Yeah. It was a complication of the amount of oil and the fact that it stayed right in the vicinity of the vessel.
For a 200,000 barrel spill is precisely these circumstances that we're talking about. So it seems that inherent in the contingency plan is the wrong contingency.
I think you have raised a very good question. I have the same question, and I feel that those of us who worked on that contingency plan and the government agencies that reviewed it and approved it were concentrating on cleaning up the oil spill. I think you've raised a question that we have to go back and address. If we're creating a safety hazard or the possibility of worsening the situation, we need to change the plan. It's just that simple.
I think this gentleman right here. I think one other point too on that 200,000 plus release.
You know, you can release $200,000 barrels, you know, catastrophically within a short period of time, and you can release that same amount over a long-term period. And there was no distinction in the wording of that contingency plan as to how that oil was released. You can handle with skimming and booming equipment oil that's released at a much slower rate, but a catastrophic release within several hours poses a unique set of circumstances as to whether or not all the boom that was at Alyeska, or whether or not all the boom that is on hand right now would have been enough to contain that. Those are questions that are really unanswerable because we'll never know. But, the way that plan was written, and it says 200,000 barrels, there's a lot of different ways that amount could be released. And then, the dispersants, again, if the quantities needed for a gradual release were on hand and more can be supplied, that's one way of handling it. If the quantities that were on hand and the magnitude of the oil that was released would make it, not effective.
What you're saying is the contingency plan doesn't address all those variations, and that's what
correct.
We're looking at.
Mr. Cornett, Dan Sather,
if I could come back to the gentleman's question about company changes in policy. There has been one very important that we initiated immediately, and that is to require all crew members to return to their vessels 4 hours before the sailing time. We felt that was a very clear step that would provide further safeguard. There are others we are considering, but we need to analyze them a little further, but that step was taken. I would also point out that there are a number of people tested for both drug and alcohol, that all of the people, including the master, showed no trace of drug. the master was the only one who showed trace of alcohol. So I think that's an important point to understand. There were a lot of folks tested, and there was only one that was positive.
Is the four-hour rule, is that on the idea that they'll sober up in 4 hours?
That was the intention. Yeah, clearly.
I just came back from Sawmill Bay where I got the vacuum truck on the flatbed on the Long Bay. I understand Virka has about a dozen of those Super Sucker vacuum trucks up on the North Slope. They seem to be working where the skimmers might not work on the heavy oil. Are there any plans for Exxon to bring in more of those trucks?
We are looking at the results of the first vacuum truck that we have out. We, at the time that we mobilized that one, we actually asked for three. There are two more either in Valdez or Whittier, I'm not sure, and we're looking now for the proper barges to put them on. So we will have three. The initial results that I got is that they are taking an awful lot of water with the oil. It's not a very selective process, and we've got to analyze it a little further to understand what we can mobilize and bring down.
Charlie McCoy with the Wall Street Journal. I have a question for you and then one for the commander. About this gasification thing again, we've had very large spills elsewhere in the world, spills even some slightly larger than this. Gasification, it must be a well-known consequence of pouring out this much oil on the water. Is it?
We've had spills before, but I don't think we had any in which such a magnitude of oil was spilled in such a short period of time and it remained right there.
Okay.
So, that was the difference. We just had an enormous amount of oil in one spot in a very quick amount of time.
Here's a question.
Okay.
Commander McCall, at what point did you know that there was a gasification problem and that might be slowing down or even causing Alyeska to decide not to try so hard to boom the vessel within 3 hours like they were supposed to?
During those first hours of the oil spill, the gasification question did not enter my mind. The main concern was to get all the equipment out there, and then obviously once you have it out there, it's a lot easier to determine what you do. But step one is to get the equipment out there.
I understand. I guess why I'm asking this is, I know you were in contact with Alyeska constantly, and it's now 12 days after the spill, and this question or this issue of gasification suddenly rises up from the sea. Why? And I know we talked at great length about what was going on. And why?
I can clarify. We're not saying that the boom wasn't put there because of gasification. We did not tell, I tried to say that, we did not tell anybody not to put the boom. We're saying that if the boom had been out there sooner, we would have been concerned. So I'm not saying that is a reason why it was not put out there. We're not saying that at all.
Let's take about two more questions. This gentleman right here and the gentleman back in there in the red sweater, and then we'll call it a day.
Bob King, Alaska Public Radio. I have a question about compensation for fishermen. The long-term impacts of this to the fish runs can be severe. I mean, damage to the spawning beds, damage to the brood stock for both herring and salmon could have an impact for years. I just want to know, how is Exxon going to base future claims for compensation for the damage to these runs in the years to come?
Well, we're going to have to do a lot of study, and we're going to have to do a lot of analysis of baseline data and compare that to future data.
Catches as a baseline and go from there? There are lots of vagaries in the fish runs. And I
know, and all those decisions haven't been made, but you have to choose a reasonable basis, whether that's 2 years or 3 years or 1 year, I don't know. But you have to start from a baseline, and then you have to compare it to what happens in the future. And you have to make some determinations from there. It's going to be a lot of study, a lot of discussion.
And we're not going to make this in a vacuum. We're going to seek the best advice we can get, and we're going to include the people who are mostly concerned with it also, people from Cordova, and we will look at the history, and it will be a very thorough study and hopefully as fair as can be.
Commander McCall, can you address the question of having us all go out on the rush tomorrow? Can you talk about logistics so we can know what's happening?
We're going to have a meeting this afternoon at 2:00 with the public relations folks from the Coast Guard, Alyeska, and the state agencies, and we're going to try to work together, get a plan for common news releases from us. But also, we're lining up, and we'll be able to get back with. I guess I'm not sure how this is all going to work, but we're trying to make arrangements to get at least some people out on the rush, and some people up in the helicopter, and some. Depending on what other resources we have around, so you can get in close enough. Otherwise, you know, you'd have to stay out, you know, a thousand yards from, you know, 3,000 feet from where the ship is. Now that might be okay for you with the lenses. I don't know, you know, plus the, but no, I know there's a whole lot of you, and we're kind of limited ourselves. That's why I want to get together with my public affairs folks, and then Exxon's in the States, and kind of work up a package for you for some time this afternoon. That's about the best I can say.
Wait, just one minute. Let's finish this last question that we left us.
Okay, I'm sorry. This is for Mr. Iorossi or yourself, Marty Klingenberg from the Fort Lauderdale News. In terms of the type of oil that was spilled, the North Slope crude, is that oil more toxic than other types of oil? Is it more difficult to clean up?
I think it's fairly light, relatively light oil. And I don't believe there's any reason why its toxicity is any higher than any other crude oil. I can't give you a scientific answer.
Are you going to give preference to the National Press Corps on this, or are you going to evenly distribute the accessibility on the rush?
Why don't we talk about that a little bit before we all disperse? Is there a limit to the number of people that can go? If there is, I need to get another boat, because I think everybody that wants to go out that has press credentials should be allowed to go. And you should state the limit.
I haven't been really tuned into this portion of the operation yet, but I know my public affairs folks, and I guess Exxon's, are working on that. I'm not sure exactly how many we can take on the rush, and again, how we're going to get you out there to begin with. You know,
the rush is the Coast Guard cutter,
right? That's the Coast Guard cutter, yeah.
Okay. Why don't you...
The air restrictions
The air restrictions are as they are right now, that...
Okay.
3 miles up and 3 miles around, or?
3 miles.
Just don't let's not.
Three times.
I was thinking it was 1,000 feet.
Okay. Yeah. It's whatever it is right now. Basically, I'm just not sure exactly which.
How many people can you take on the rush?
I don't know. We got to figure out.
Okay. We will work with Commander McCall and find out how many people he can take, and the rest of you, I will arrange a vessel for you to get out there, and we will post the information at the Exxon office and wherever else we can get it out. But you can find out before the end of the day at our office.
Good, because they need the guys that want to sell the boats need the money to pay.
And with the announcement by Don Cornette of steps being planned or taken to get the press out to the Bligh Island Reef area when the Exxon Valdez will be refloated, this press conference has officially come to a close. I'm Dave Hammack. You're listening to coverage of the Exxon briefing on day 12 via the services of the Alaska Public Radio Network, Alaskom, and KCHU Radio. We understand that local radio station KVAK here in Valdez is also taking the feed and sharing it with ABC. It was quite a conference today, quite a bit of information imparted. We heard briefings from Frank Iorossi, who is the president of Exxon Shipping, a statement by Don Cornette, and also a fairly extensive litany of what's going on from Suzanne Stopey, who is the Exxon representative, a spokesman for the Bird and Mammal Rescue Center. We had an introduction of former Exxon Alaska Operations Manager Monty Taylor, who's been brought back evidently from retirement to assist in dealing with other communities around Alaska that may be affected. Starting at the beginning of the conference, we heard from Don Cornette that at 8 a.m. this morning, the 4th of April, that the lightering had been completed, and that 1 p.m. Wednesday, the 5th, which is tomorrow, Wednesday the 5th of April, is the first target for the refloating effort, and salvage is certainly now the focus. The salvage chief, salvage vessel, will be on station tomorrow. There are 6 tugs planned to tow the Exxon Valdez the 30 miles to Outside Bay on the southwest corner of Naked Island. We also heard that in addition to Portland, Oregon, as a possible eventual destination for the Exxon Valdez, that the Far East destinations are being considered as possible alternatives. ships. The San Juan hatchery is clearly the most critical area endangered right now. Many of the hatcheries in the northern and northwestern part of Prince William Sound are evidently beyond the reach of the oil unless there is a significant weather change. Weather is an issue throughout the press conference. A fairly heavy snow was falling outside the Valdez City Council chambers. For residents of South Central or Southeastern Alaskan communities, the weather in Valdez has been remarkably benign for the past 12 days, with only a couple of days of cloudiness and only one day of windstorms. The clouds definitely are a factor here today. The mountains ringing Valdez, peaks up to 7,000 feet, are virtually invisible. And although the snow has now stopped, flight operations have been severely impacted. The Valdez Airport for the LAF has been averaging 600 to 700 landings a day, which we understand is more activity than Anchorage International Airport sees. Those flight operations severely curtailed by the weather now, and we have yet have no idea how that will impact work out in the Prince William Sound on the recovery area. We also heard today that dispersants were used south of Montague Island, but further burning is unlikely. We also heard that there will probably be no further burning. It will be unlikely because of the water concentration. Burning will be unlikely. We just had an announcement from Don Cornett about tomorrow's briefing. I'll see if I can get his attention and find out what exactly was said.
This is KCHU, listener-supported radio for Valdez.
The time of these press conferences has been moved forward to 10:30, but the press conference may or may not happen tomorrow because of the salvage effort. So there may not be an actual press briefing tomorrow at 10:30. Subsequent briefings will be at an earlier time than the one that started today. We will advise stations and let people know, listeners know, what to expect. As I was saying, dispersants have been used in the Gulf of Alaska, south of Montague Island. Burning is no longer considered likely. The Exxon office is ready to respond with claims and such. We've been given the phone numbers for Valdez and Cordova. We heard from Suzanne Stopey, as I said, of the Bird and Mammal Rescue Center. As of 9 o'clock this morning, 121 birds have been brought to the center. Five have been released. No new releases are currently scheduled. 15 of those birds, 121 that have come in, have died. All 45 have been cleaned. 44 otters have been received. All have been cleaned. 21 have died. Six were shipped to San Diego. Only five arrived. One died in Anchorage at the animal shelter there, suffering from trauma in the flight, or trauma, I think, from the oil spill, compounded by the transportation. There have been a temporary delay in the bringing in of otters to the cleaning center in Valdez. They're working on a remedy of that. The otter center is being moved from the Prince William Sound Community College's dorm area to their new facility, formerly the Groudon Harrison Elementary School in Valdez, currently under remodeling and to become the new education center for Prince William Sound Community College. By sometime tomorrow morning, there'll be a facility completed to handle up to 96 otters. Also, we heard that Dr. John Blake, a pathologist, will arrive to begin investigating the actual cause of death, how the otters are being affected, what is really causing the mortality rate. And Michael Fry, a toxicologist specializing in birds, is also underway. We then heard a fairly extensive briefing by Frank Arasi, the president of Exxon Shipping. He recapped briefly the original three priorities, the oil on the tanker, salvaging the tanker, and getting the rest of the oil picked up. 984,000 barrels of oil have been lightered out of the Exxon Valdez. Again, that process concluded at 8 o'clock this morning. At 1:30 Wednesday, 1330 hours, Wednesday the 5th, the first possible refloat target. There was a fair amount of explanation about the technical steps, showing charts and diagrams. Essentially, they hope to raise the vessel a few feet, just enough to clear the reef, move it off the reef, stabilize it, and then begin a slow trip being pulled by tugs over to Naked Island. There was quite a bit of talk about skimmers. The Navy has five skimmers here. They're belt-type skimmers. Other than those that are pulled by, there are several others. Every kind of skimmer design, I think, in use anywhere in the world has been in Prince William Sound. Now that the oil has become heavy, gummy, and forming into tarballs and such, the Navy belt-type skimmers are considered to be the most effective. Five are here. There are 13 more skimmers in the U.S. Navy stockpiles. Exxon has requested them. No word as yet whether they will get them. There's one more similar skimmer in the United Kingdom, and two in France. All have been requested. We heard from Frank Arossi that compared to other spills, the skimming is going well, but he repeated the oft-heard statement that skimming, mechanical recovery, is an extremely slow process. One problem they're experiencing is getting the oil out of the skimmers and into transfer vessels. There are two barges that are holding the recovered oil. So far, there are 10,500 barrels of oil on those barges, with much more oil in bladders on skimmers, and because of the gumminess of the oil, the consistency, some of the skimmers have basically been clogged up. They're unable to get the oil out of them. So the part of the problem is the skimmers, or even the skimmers when they're working, it's hard to get them unloaded and cleared to get back out to work. A lot of booming is still going on. Frank Arossi announced that there is 50,000 feet of boom in and around Sawmill Bay, and the heavy sea curtain boom, the 43-inch heavyweight boom that was requested, has arrived in Anchorage, is being trucked to Valdez, and the Coast Guard will have a cutter arriving to pick it up, take it out. A work vessel has been dispatched, will be standing by in Sawmill Bay, 165-foot boat, to deploy this heavy boom as the fourth layer of boom defense for the San Juan Hatchery at Sawmill Bay. When that arrives, there'll be 66,000 feet of boom at Sawmill Bay. That's over half the boom in all of Prince William Sound. In addition to particular questions, also the Soviet Union's offer of a skimming vessel has been reevaluated. It has been requested. It'll be here within 10 days to 2 weeks. The vessel is currently at Sakhalin Island, just north of Japan, on the Russian East or Siberian coast. The vessel is on the way. That pretty much covers all the points raised regarding the efforts going on currently. There was some question about the gag order, the quote-unquote gag order that has been issued. A statement by Exxon people that there has been no gag issue ordered, that only Exxon personnel are authorized to speak for Exxon, but people under contract, Exxon employees, can certainly speak about what they are doing. And a reassurance by Don Cornett, at least, that no one has been told they will be fired if they speak to the press. There was another question raised. Bill Allen, the CEO of Vico International, the primary contractor employed by Exxon in the cleanup effort, says Exxon has not put a gag order on us, but he did indicate that his employees are supposed to be working during work hours and not talking to the press, and if they want to talk to the press after they're off duty, that's their business. We got from the Coast Guard, we heard that the shipping in and out of Valdez will be stopped during the salvage, refloating, and movement of the vessel, the 30 miles to an outside bay. We also heard that the Coast Guard's briefly allowing nighttime, almost normal shipping operations, that order was rescinded almost immediately at the request of the state. The port captain, Commander McCall, said he had the authority to issue the order to resume almost normal operations. That was done when almost all of the oil was lightered off, and his overflights indicated there was no problem with the tanker lane. He said he issued the order allowing nighttime traffic without consulting anyone, that again being within his authority. He said when the state protested, they immediately rescinded the order in deference to the state concerns. At this point, daytime operations only are allowed for the tankers, and they still must be escorted in and out of the port by two tugs. There was a question about changes in Exxon policies regarding crews drinking. There is a new policy, at least at the Valdez terminal, maybe elsewhere in Exxon, that crew members must be on the vessel a minimum of 4 hours prior to sailing. And Frank Arossi did remind the press that the only crew member who was tested, who tested positive to alcohol, was the captain. Many other crew members had been tested. None of them, including the captain, tested positive for any drug other than alcohol. There was quite a bit of talk today about the problem of gasification and that the catastrophic release of that much oil created an enormously explosive and hazardous cloud of gas over the spill, and that had that been boomed and contained, it is quite likely any sort of spark would have resulted in the total destruction of the ship and the release of the million gallons of crude oil that did stay on board. Questions were raised by the press. Wasn't this then a flaw in the Prince William Sound response plan that indicated booming the vessel was a preferred response for even a catastrophic spill of 200,000 barrels? And the Exxon personnel acknowledged that this was in fact a flaw in the plan and would have to be addressed. That was what happened today. Again, tomorrow, we're anticipating that most of the press corps will be en route to the site of the Exxon Valdez and the attempt to refloat it. There'll be hardly anybody in town other than KCHE Radio to have a press conference for. Accordingly, it is likely there'll be no briefing in the morning. We may indeed have a briefing in the afternoon, although it is more likely it will be Thursday before there is a scheduled briefing to give results of the refloat effort. And we'll broadcast that. We have been advised that future briefings will be at 10:30 rather than at 11 to allow East Coast reporters with East Coast deadlines more time to file their stories. For this broadcast, I'd like to thank the efforts. Trish King has been volunteering. She's a former a member of the cabin radio crew over in the Big Lake Wasilla area, has been involved with Talkeetna Community Radio. She's been over in Valdez for a few days now, has been working with us diligently as a volunteer. Trish King has been sitting in this broadcast. Also, APRN technician Chris Bedilek. And back at KCHU Studios, James Winchester is on the board. I'm Dave Hammack, and at the Valdez City Council Chambers in Valdez, Alaska, this broadcast has been made possible by cooperative efforts of Alascom and the Alaska Public Radio Network and KCHU Radio in Valdez. We're also pooling our resources and broadcasting with KVAK Radio in Valdez, and they're affiliated with ABC Radio News. Again, until tomorrow or Thursday, whenever the next public briefing is, I'm Dave Hammack, and this is the Alaska Public Radio Network.